This is Where We Live.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 56 of Literary Disco.
From Slate, it's The Gist, I'm Mike Pesca.
If you're listening to Song Exploder, my name is Hrishikesh Hirway.
This is 99% Invisible, I'm Roman Mars.
And those are just a few of the thousands of podcasts you have a choice to download today. I'm John Dankosky. Podcasts range from wide-ranging conversation about books with friends to a daily stream of consciousness about the news to a deep dive into how music gets made to a neatly crafted piece of storytelling about design. That range is kind of the cool thing about podcasts. They can be about anything. They can be any length. They don't have to adhere to basic broadcast rules. They can target a very small audience, or they can go after the same audience as, say, public radio. Hey, that's us. You're taking our audience. It's no surprise that the iTunes charts of the most popular podcasts, just full of public radio shows, offshoots of those shows, and shows by those who've escaped the public radio system for life on this new frontier. Coming up in a bit, Mike Pesca, host of the Slate Daily podcast, The Gist, will join us. He contributes reports and commentary to NPR. But joining us now in studio is Julia Pestel. She's host of Literary Disco. She's also director of writing at the Mark Twain House. She's a writer herself, and she's a comedian, and she does an awful lot of things. But you started a podcast some time ago, Julia. Why did you do that, amongst all the other things that you're doing?
Sure. Well, the podcast is it's my baby. I love it so much because it's just it's so much fun. So the way that it started was two friends and I, who went to graduate school together for MFAs in writing, we decided that we wanted to basically continue our conversation about books, and that's really how it formed. We were listening to other book podcasts, but most of them were really serious and really dry, or swung really far the other way and were really, really light. And we wanted to create a podcast that actually represented the way people read. So, you know, one week we'll read Moby Dick, and then the next week we'll read a graphic novel, and then the next week we'll read The Hardy Boys, and on and on and on.
You read Moby Dick in just the one week, huh?
Well, no, we can't. We only release an episode every other week for that exact reason, is we can't read anything of any heft in that time, and we don't release, I'm sure we'll talk more about this later, but we don't release our episodes in real time. We have a huge advantage in that we can record a bunch of short, easy episodes while we're preparing for a really long one.
So I think one of the things that we want to really get to in here, and we're going to talk more about the nuts and bolts of your podcast in a little bit and get into some of this with the other shows that we'll be talking about, but how in your mind is this different from radio? Like, if someone gave you a radio show to talk about books, would that be a better thing, a worse thing, different somehow than what you're doing here?
Well, it would be awesome. And if you're offering, yes. But no, it's very different in a lot of ways. One is that we can say anything we want. So I'm sure it was difficult to find a clip because the conversations are so casual and may not be NPR appropriate. But we also can record whenever we want. So my colleagues are actually, they live on the West Coast. Ryder Strong and Todd Goldberg, they live out there. And we usually record around 10 p.m. my time. So I get home from all the other things I do and then jump on Google Hangout, and we each record our tracks. And it's just, it's easier to have a casual conversation on a podcast than in an NPR studio, I think.
And if you want to have one of these casual conversations with us, because it still happens here on live radio as well, you can join us at 860-275-7266. I want to bring into the conversation Sam Greenspan. He's one of the producers on 99% Invisible. 99% is the brainchild of Roman Mars. He's sort of a refugee of the traditional public radio system, but has been doing things, well, in a very, very different way, exploding some of these ideas about how we listen to radio and creating a podcast that, along with a very, very successful Kickstarter, has an awful lot of fans and followers around the country. Sam, one of the producers on the show. Sam, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Hey, maybe you could describe, Sam, what you think a podcast is, maybe through the 99% invisible lens, if you would.
Well, I mean, to me, a podcast is just any type of audio show or audio storytelling that's just where the primary way that people find it is through the internet. And that it's, I mean, some people don't like the term podcast, but I mean, that's what it is. We are broadcasting to your iPod or to your listening device or to your computer. It's just a way of being heard that isn't necessarily through the broadcast spectrum.
So how is that different than broadcasting through the broadcast spectrum? What's the consideration that might be different in the way you put together an episode of 99% that maybe it's a different thought process than if you worked at NPR making a show?
I mean, I admire you for doing a live show every morning. I think it's an amazing skill and one that I do not aspire to have because it's its own type of animal. We have the privilege of getting to spend a long time on, you know, I mean, our show started out as a 4.5-minute insert into Morning Edition on KALW in San Francisco. And now we've sort of, because we have this open format, you know, it could be as long as we want it to be. It's grown into, now our episodes are generally about 15 to 20 minutes, sometimes as long as a half an hour. That's rare though. And, we don't have any particular time pegs to meet. It's stories are as long or as short as we want them to be. And, we have, you know, time to craft them and make them, you know, as polished and refined as we can make them.
We're talking with Sam Greenspan. He's a producer of 99% Invisible, which, of course, is hosted by Roman Mars. It's available, as all the podcasts that we're talking about today are, on through iTunes, but it's also aligned with some other organizations we'll be talking about in just a bit. Let's just listen to a clip from 99%.
All right, well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse
Management Oversight by Tori Malatia.
Audio newspaper for a visual world.
George! Answer me this podcast.com.
The show's produced by Speaking Into Microphones.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
Stand by to open Julia.
Whether I'm walking on secret stairs or doing the dishes.
Open.
Or driving the car.
You're there, but you're somewhere else, too.
We producers aspire to create driveway moments, TM. Stories so good that listeners can't leave their car until they're over.
I think part of what makes a driveway moment is the end of that moment, when you realize what time it is. You could have been staring at a clock all along, but for a while, for once, it had no power over you.
That's 99% Invisible, describing in its own way what the podcast is. We've used that idea, Sam, in public radio for years, this driveway moment. That's really the aspiration here, huh?
I mean, yeah, that, except with, you know, with podcasting, our driveway moments don't have to happen in the driveway. They can happen, you know, if you take the subway to work, or if you walk to work, or if you just, you know, want to lie in bed at night and stare at the ceiling and ponder what it all means as you listen to your podcast or your computer or however else. But yeah, pretty much.
I want to ask you, Julian, we're going to get to a phone call here in just a moment, but this idea of something being as long as it needs to be, mm-hmm. it's, in many ways, something that works against one of the things that I like about radio. I'm not saying it's a good thing or bad thing, and I consider this all the time. What would I do if I had an hour and a half show or a show that only had to last for 20 minutes? When you're making any sort of art and you're a writer, if you put in a frame, I've got 1,000 words to write, that helps you in some ways say, that's how I'm going to construct it to that 1,000-word limit. If you're told, write it as long as you want, it could create, I would think, some creative problems for you because things that are as long as they need to be sometimes can sprawl on too long or take too long to produce. You get my point. What do you think about
Absolutely.
That, Joy?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's a big challenge for podcasters to stop talking and know when when to stop. But I think that one thing that I really love about podcasting is our relationship with our audience is very direct. So we can see when people turn it off. We can see, you know, when people review it. We know basically how long people listen and what parts of the podcast they're responding to. So Literary Disco has gotten longer and shorter at various times because our audience is reacting. We're always in dialogue with them. So if there's something they really like a kind of segment or discussion, we'll give it a little more time. Or if sometimes we're having a discussion and we're like, we don't want to fake, you know, that we have anything more to say about this. So the end. So that does create a flexibility, but you're right. You have to have a lot of self-control to not be self-indulgent and just go on and on.
Sam, what do you think about that? The idea that without the constraints of the 4-minute time slot on Morning Edition, that now all of a sudden you have to really think about, is this worth the 18 minutes or should this really only be 2 minutes? How do you grapple with that problem of framing?
Well, all of us, I mean, so there's 4 of us on the staff, Roman, myself, Katie Mingle, and Avery Trufflin. We all come from public radio. We all have worked on shows with the clock. We've all worked on shows that are bound by typical constraints of the broadcast medium. And so I think once you work in a medium and kind of get the feel of what it means to produce, you know, a 4.5-minute segment, a 6-minute segment, and what the rules are with those regards, you kind of internalize what a story is supposed to sound like, what it's supposed to be like. And we will, you know, it's not like, we do discuss, like, does this warrant 18 minutes? Maybe it's a 16-minute story. Maybe it's a 12-minute story. Maybe this does warrant 25 minutes on our podcast. But I think it's just sort of a sixth sense that you get about just how long, you know, like when something, you know, we all have kind of an intuition about when something feels long, when we think people will kind of just go with us down an alley into some strange idea. It's just something that, you know, like, you know, I mean, how long should a song be? You know, how long should a novel be? I mean, they're just things that you pick up by doing it, and whatever feels right to you, with the guidance of your peers.
Let's go to Pete, who's calling from Watertown. Hi, Pete. Go ahead. Hi, Pete. Are you there? Oh, Pete's not quite there yet. Maybe we'll get Pete back on the line. I know who is there. Mike Pesca joins us now. Mike is the host of The Gist. It's a Slate podcast. He, of course, well-known to many of our listeners as an NPR sports reporter and a reporter on many other things, and a kind of regular contributor as well to the Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. He joins us from NPR's Midtown Manhattan studios. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Well, history of podcasts, Pete is always there. Pete is never dropping the phone in a podcast.
I know. See, that's
we win.
That is one of the problems, right? See, I try to make this case for live call-in radio all the time, that callers, yeah, when they call in, provide this little spark of something you just don't expect. You don't know what's going to happen next in a call-in radio show. Often what happens next is Pete from Watertown isn't on the line. But,
right,
of course, in a podcast...
Or sometimes worse, yeah, he is and is just droning on about the gold standard or whatever. So I agree. Call-in is good, but some of the worst of radio are just those callers. I always say to myself, sorry to hijack this one, but this is a passion of mine. I always say to myself, the deal with call-in radio is, why not just give the show over to unqualified unprofessionals for large swaths of time? That can be a big problem, as you know.
I think that what we're going to do is we're going to have you back in a couple of weeks. We're going to put together a call-in radio show segment just to talk about these very, very issues. But for now, Mike, what is a podcast in your mind?
Well, you know, some people think that the actual word is a problem because it connotes that one delivery system of Apple. But I think we could get over that, and it doesn't really matter. Once things get established, does it really matter that, you know, Chips Ahoy cookies are called Chips Ahoy? It's not like we're into being sailors. That's, you know, a vestige of a bygone era. So I think, you know, a podcast is essentially an on-demand radio show. And an on-demand radio show without, as you were talking about, all the restrictions that a lot of radio shows have, be they FCC restrictions, time restrictions, taste restrictions, also the restriction or the responsibility to be broad and not to let people behind. So one of the great things about podcasts is they could be really niche. So I just interviewed this guy who has the Riverdale podcast. Riverdale is in the home that Archie lives in. And he talks about the latest developments in the Archie comics all the time. So obviously Archie got killed last week, and that was a big day for the Riverdale podcast. But also in my podcast, which is pretty general and very much about the news and 27 minutes a day, and we have one news segment and one art segment. But, you know, I feel like if I lose a listener here or there because I'm literally talking too fast or making references they don't get or giving opinions or at least, you know, showing my personality in ways that chafes them, I'm fine with that. I think the most interesting things in life are things that aren't going to appeal to most people. And I think broadcasting, even if they don't know it, is really trying to appeal to so many people that they lose appeal. And that's why everyone on, you know, a morning show, a Happy Talk, Des Moines Today, says the most anodyne, inoffensive things because they think you have to appeal to the whole audience. Podcasts don't.
Mm-hmm. Julia, does that sound about right to you?
Oh, exactly right. I mean, a lot of my favorite podcasts are really niche. And there's a really popular podcast right now that I'm sure a lot of people have heard of called Welcome to Night Vale, which is this really strange long-form storytelling. And they're just telling one continuous story. And it's really appeals to, like, hipster teens, and it's really, really, really strange, and it's one of the most popular podcasts out there because it's not afraid to be niche and to be weird.
Sam Greenspan, before I let you go, what are your favorite podcasts, aside, of course, from the one that you work on every day, 99% Invisible?
Sure. Well, we started a radio collective with some of our favorite shows, who happens to be produced by a bunch of our friends. So it's called Radiotopia, and that includes Benjamin Walker's Theory of Everything, Strangers by Leah Tao, The Truth, which is produced by Jonathan Mitchell, which is a radio fiction show, Love and Radio. The Kitchen Sisters is Fugitive Waves podcast. And I feel like I'm missing one. So Radiotopia is a way of promoting, like, you know, trying to, like, lend the success of what we do onto, you know, onto other shows and to help us all get known. And I'm a big fan of Mike Pesca. Thanks for your show, Mike.
Thanks for listening.
And thanks
first
for,
time, long time.
Yeah, he's going to hang up and listen. Sam Greenspan, a producer of 99% Invisible, of course, hosted by Roman Mars. As with all the podcasts we'll be talking about in today's program, you can find them in multiple ways through their website. But, of course, you can go on iTunes and just subscribe to a podcast. It's the easiest thing because it then ends up in your phone so you can take it wherever you want. Sam, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back from a break, we'll talk a little bit more with Mike Pesca about how he went from being a broadcaster on NPR to being a podcaster on Slate. We'll also continue with Julia Pistel. She co-hosts the podcast Literary Disco. You can join us with your favorite podcasts on our website, WNPR.org, or let us know on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live.
The hell is a podcast? I mean, why don't you just tape it? What are you doing?
You don't have to tape it these days, Frank. You just record it right onto the computer.
And once we start recording, Frank, I'm going to need you to stop eating those crackers. It's incredibly annoying, and it's all anyone's going to be able to hear. So, Dennis and Dee Reynolds here.
Inaugural podcast. We're talking technology today, the big T.
Do you listen to podcasts?
I do.
What's your favorite podcast?
KFC Barstool Radio, because I think it's funny.
I listen to The Moth. We started listening to them on long car trips, and I just love the personality coming through in the stories. My husband listens to a lot of podcasts himself, and actually we're on our way to a family reunion next week, and he said he downloaded some for our children, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's some audio from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, along with some voices gathered in the streets of West Hartford by our intern, Lily Tyson. Not everyone knows that much about podcasts, but more and more Americans are listening to them every single day. You know, people still listen to the radio, of course, like you, listening to Where We Live. But you can also find us on podcast as well. We're talking about some of the differences between podcasting and broadcasting and whether or not it's a little bit of a revolution in podcasting these days with people like Julia Pistel, who's the co-host of Literary Disco and director of writing at the Mark Twain House. Their podcast takes a look at books, and they talk at length about some of their favorite books, and they laugh along the way and play games with their listeners. Mike Pesca is here. He's host of the Slate Daily podcast, The Gist. You may know him from his work at NPR, but he started this podcast with Slate just within the last year. Mike, before we get to one of our phone calls, how's the transition been? I mean, you said it's 27 minutes a day, and some people might say, well, you know, there's lots of public radio shows that are an hour a day. You know, he can do this easily. It's got to be a little bit of work for you, though, right?
Yeah, people in radio kind of have, when they know what kind of podcast it is, which isn't just open the mic and talk about something, but which is a bunch of interviews that are edited and which is sort of a comment at the end that I call the spiel and often has a lot of production value. And the thing I do at the end, which is about 5 or 6 minutes, could be commentary, but often it's essentially like a piece, like a piece that you'd hear on NPR. It wouldn't just be sports. The other day I talked about the real risks of the brain-eating amoeba, for instance. And I do think that that piece, it was kind of – people liked it. It was much more inflected with opinion that you'd ever get on an NPR piece. I was saying things like, this is not a risk. The news media is hyping this. This is a 1 in 100 million shot. I don't know that you'd get that level of, you know, just the reporter coming out and telling you that flat out on NPR. But, you know, that is normally the sort of thing that would take a reporter all day to do. Now, I have to do a whole show around that. And so the calculation I make is that All Things Considered is a great show. And they have, I don't know, what, 30 people on staff, something like that. So per half hour, it's like 6 people, not counting 100 reporters around the world. And my show is about a quarter of that with 2 people. Andrea, the producer, and I. So, yeah, it's quite a lift.
It's quite a lift. One of the things that's the big difference that people will hear when they listen to The Gist is that kind of blend of commentary and reporting. It's a little bit different mix. How have you felt making the transition from being the guy who was always a little bit on the edge with NPR toward giving your opinion in a way that reporters aren't supposed to being someone who is free to just be able to say, yeah, that's good, that's bad, I like this, or this sucks?
Right. You got to do it so that it's not off-putting, or if it is, you know, especially for people with the wrong opinions. But when I was doing, when I was on NPR as a reporter, I had a little more leeway, I think, because of the subject matter, sports. So I had reports. I mean, I remember I was covering the Heat won their first NBA championship, and I was telling people, you know, in my report that you can hate LeBron James, but really, who's, are you doing yourself a favor? What you're doing is missing greatness. Now, if I was to take that subject matter and apply it to, I don't know, Gaza, that would be absolutely radioactive. And I probably wouldn't be, you know, that forceful in my opinion. But so I did have a little leeway with NPR. I think people want that with sports, but I think people want that with communication. And my listener is the NPR listener. So they don't want a lot of opinions thrown at them, and they don't want Fox, and they might not even in this format want MSNBC. You know, I think Chris Hayes does a good job, for instance, but I don't know. That's not the podcast I'm doing. So I've stopped talking about the idea that I give a lot of opinion, and I try to frame it as, and this is accurate, I give a lot of personality. And when you talk to someone and when they're engaging, you find out their opinions on things. So it might be, you know, my opinion on a serious world matter, or it might be my opinion on how V-neck T-shirts have a little extra oomph that they don't really deserve.
Let's actually listen to a little bit from a recent podcast, and this is on one of those serious matters.
I know that Putin draws strength and prestige from such actions as taking Crimea, but has Eastern Ukraine been worth it for him?
Eastern Ukraine has not gone the way that Putin expected it to go. He seems to have genuinely believed that he would be able to cause in eastern Ukraine a kind of popular uprising against the Kiev government. And he tried to foment such an uprising in several places, including Kharkov and Odessa and several other cities. This failed. The question is, has he drawn the conclusion from it? The conclusion that he should draw is that Ukraine is in fact a sovereign state, that Ukrainians feel themselves to be Ukrainian, that they remain loyal to Kiev, and they don't want to be part of Russia.
That's a little bit of The Gist with Mike Pesca, the host of the Slate Daily Podcast, talking with Ann Applebaum, who writes for Slate and for The Washington Post, talking about the recent downing of a Malaysian air jet and the impact on Russia and Ukraine and on the rest of the world. One of the things I kind of take away from that, Mike, in listening to your podcast every day is you talk about it being personality. I want to know, just the same way I guess I really want to know how Jon Stewart's going to do a take on the day of the news of the day, I wanted to hear how you decided to tackle this story. And in that show, you tackled it with Ann Applebaum, who is, you know, one of the real experts on Eastern Europe in the entire world. You also did your spiel on that later on, but sandwiched in the middle of the show is a conversation about penguin guano. And I'm, yeah. And I guess that's sort of the thing that makes the show so interesting to me, but it's a very, very delicate balance putting these two things together every single day in a way that, you know, informs people, gives your take, but also doesn't go too far to the silly, too far to the serious.
The two alt titles for the show, the silver and bronze medalists, were 20-ish minutes and could be anything. Yeah. So that tells you, that's informative, right? The show, the day before, I talked about the power of that front page New York Times article, which very sparely just listed the items and the debris and the mundane items of life that were found among the wreckage of Malaysian Air 17. And I talked about the idea of the telling detail. So it was about journalism and it was about mortality and things like that. The exact spot in that show, which is the spiel, which I do for 6 minutes at the end, the day before, was pegged to the death of Archie. And I did a fake newscast with all these horrible things happening to different comic strip characters. So, you know, Snoopy bites Linus and has to be put down, all this stuff. So, yeah, it can be real. It can be really eclectic. And I think you also heard in that interview that I definitely want to do interviews and get good opinions from people. But then every once in a while, something will synthesize. And then maybe I'll either ask a very inflected question or do an interview with a bit of a point of view, or I'll put it in the spiel. So, you know, I have talked to foreign policy experts. I talked to conservatives. I talked to liberals about how fearful should we be of Putin. But I've also done a spiel sort of calling out a lot of Republicans in Congress, like Lindsey Graham and John McCain. And what I was saying is that they keep they have this weak and strong construction, and it's really convenient. And Putin is strong and Obama is weak. And here's everything that's wrong with that construction. So I just put that out there as my opinion. You know, that's my opinion. Then when you come and hear me talking to Ann Applebaum about Putin, you sort of know where I stand. But I'm also trying to elicit this expert's best take on it.
Rachel's in Stonington. Hey, Rachel, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the value of not only literary and news podcasts, But the comedy and nerd-based podcast that you might have been talking about before, the more niche ones.
The nerd-based podcast. What's a nerd-based podcast?
Oh, I
well, can... Comedy Network Nerdist by Chris Hardwick is hugely popular. It has various podcasts like How Stuff Works, The Indoor Kids, You Made It Weird. So many things that many young people are listening to just sort of to get their minds off of, I don't know, any sort of bad things. But it gets them interested and definitely gives me some of those driveway moments.
So, Rachel, I have to ask, how is podcasting different for you than gathering this information in some other way? Obviously, we've said it's different than the radio because you turn on the radio and what's on is on, right? You don't get to choose it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of different ways to consume information, obviously. You can watch little videos. You can search for how to do things on YouTube right now and find a million probably entertaining videos along the way. There's plenty of stuff to read. What is it about podcasting, getting it into your headphones, that you like?
Podcasting is such a mobile experience. I can do it anywhere, in the car, while I'm getting ready in the morning, doing my makeup, while I'm at the gym. It's such an easy way to get information.
Rachel, thank you very much for your phone call. And you were, of course, nodding along, Julia. You know all about nerd culture and podcasting in a way that perhaps I don't.
Well, podcasting really got big through two specific channels. One is this nerd culture thing. So, you know, these, and we kind of started to touch on it, really niche topics. You know, you can have superhero things or people nerding out on things that, you know, we just, nerds, film nerds can talk for 5 hours about a movie. So we have Film Spotting, which is a great podcast. But also comedians, that's a huge, she mentioned that too. Comedians started to use podcasts because, you know, it's a way to have this chatty voice that can be anything you want it to be. So comedians really started to push hard into podcasting. There's so many comedy podcasts and like Mark Maron's interview podcast. It's a huge one, too. And even things like Hardcore History, it's like true nerd thing where you can listen to 14 hours on the history of Genghis Khan. So these kind of niche ideas that are so a part of nerd culture are really what got a podcast to a lot of people, including myself. And I think it's because podcasts are open to wit in a way that traditional radio sometimes isn't or hasn't been because it's so news focused. So it's kind of like having Oscar Wilde in your ear. With these kind of things. And one thing I was thinking about, too, that makes it really different is a lot of podcasts have multiple hosts. So on my podcast, we're not afraid to have strong opinions because I know the other two will probably have a different opinion. So there's a balance to that rather than one person freaking out. Although Mike Pesca is allowed to do that because he's always right.
because he's always
Julia,
right.
Julia, have you ever listened to the Star Wars Minute?
Do you know yes, that one? I have. Yeah.
Star Wars Minute literally takes a minute of the film Star Wars and talks about it for 15 seconds. So if Star Wars is an hour and 40 minute film, you know, they're going to have 100 episodes and they all talk about a minute and it works. I mean, obviously, if you're not a huge Star Wars geek, do you care? And another great example, the intersection of nerd and comedy, Flophouse. Now, Flophouse is with three guys. Two of them are writers for The Daily Show. So brilliant guys who are worth, you know, their time is worth a lot of money. But what they do is they just sort of review and discuss for an hour and 10 minutes terrible movies. Now, this is a dead on arrival pitch to a network because if there are terrible movies, people won't have seen them. And that's mostly the case. But if their podcast, it's fun when you haven't seen the movie, but when you have and it really annoys you and then the Flophouse does a take on it, it's brilliant. And sometimes I almost want to see terrible movies if I know the Flophouse has done their take on it.
Oh, I've done it. There's another one called How Did This Get Made? Where it's just making fun of terrible movies, and I have actually gone and watched the movies afterwards because it's so funny.
Well, one of the things that you both do in your podcast, and I know, Julia, we want to listen to a little bit, is it's often a really great place to play games with listeners or to have recurring segments. Each episode of Literary Disco starts out with some sort of game. Let's listen to a little bit of a game called Judging a Book by Its Cover. Can you explain what it is first to us?
Sure. Basically, it's something that you would do in a living room with only your nerdiest friends. One of us takes a book off our shelf and reads the first paragraph, and the other people have to either guess what it is, which is almost impossible, or just take a guess where it's set and what it's about.
Okay, so let's listen to a little bit of this game.
Amid all of this was a workplace, too. 400 acres of brush, steel, and glass on the headquarters of the most influential company in the world. The sky above was spotless and blue.
The Circle by Dave Eggers.
Yes!
Wow.
Well, that was pretty good.
That was incredible. That was only like 2 weeks ago. But yeah, we play a lot of games. Another game we play, which I really love, is we call it Classics Corner with 2 K's. And we write 2 fake paragraphs from a book, and then there's 1 real one, and you have to detect which is which. But
oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah, so I once basically convinced the other 2 guys that I had written Middlemarch, which made me feel really good about myself. So we just play with books in a way that, you know, we're not taking them too seriously while still honoring, you know, the literature and the quality of it.
And the whole point is that you have to have some sort of interaction with your listeners. And so you're getting emails from people and people are getting in touch with you and helping to play along these games in a way that I think we alluded to before, that maybe radio can't. When you broadcast, the way we figure out who's listening is Nielsen tells us how many people are listening per quarter hour or over the course of a week. Whereas when you talk about your listeners, you like know who they are. You know specifically who's downloading the podcast sometimes.
Yeah. And one thing that's really cool about podcasts is that, you know, or at least mine, is we don't have a relationship to real time, really. So when we get a new listener, they're going to listen to 60 episodes, and we can see that happening. You know, they'll jump in and then they'll listen to all the back episodes, or they'll go and they'll listen to only the books they've read, which is totally fine. And so we try to mix it up and do books that a lot of people have read so that they feel like they have an entry point at any point in time, rather than keeping up with the news or only experiencing it incidentally.
But Mike, you said it doesn't bother you so much in this new world if you have someone who gets upset and stops listening because you were talking too fast or they got offended. You're always going to get somebody new along the way. What's your relationship with the listeners like, the people who get in touch with you about the podcast?
Well, that's something, even when I was in public radio, if someone sent me a letter, I usually would respond to them. And sometimes the angriest people turn the nicest with, oh, my God, you actually cared. So my podcast, we do have a pretty big audience, you know, it's in the tens of thousands. And so, but I still think that we can work on that more. And I think sometimes the ones that are a little more niche have that instant connection. But the idea of our podcast, or one of the ideas that Andy Bowers, who's a former NPR guy who now runs the Slate podcast, he says, you know, it comes out every afternoon. So let's say you're driving home and listening to All Things Considered, and that report comes on that's like, you know, the third report of the week on the Eastern Warbler, and you're just not that into it. So you change over to my podcast, and we'll definitely entertain or engage with you for, you know, 27 minutes. Or a half hour. It's that alternative to All Things Considered that you know is going to be a little bit spicier. So in that way, it's not exactly kind of hitting the pleasure centers of, oh my God, he's talking right to me. I mean, I hope I'm like a columnist that you really love. I hope I'm giving you the really interesting takes on the news, but it's not as exactly as, you know, giving you that dopamine rush that a great, you know, literary game will. And it does strike me, we were talking about, we've used the phrase nerdy a lot, but what is nerdy sometimes a synonym with? Things like niche and bold and creative and daring and nonconformity. And I think that's a great appeal of podcasts. And I also think that our culture, even the things that are massive, the nerdy part of them sometimes is the greatest thing. Like Kanye West is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, hip-hop stars out there. And this is a guy who's totally embraced nerdiness. And, you know, LeBron James is the number one basketball star, and he shows up to press conferences with fake glasses and a backpack. So I do think we are becoming slightly nerdier, and I think podcasts are right there positioned to take advantage of this aspect of our culture.
We're talking with Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Slate daily podcast, The Gist. He also contributes reports and commentary to NPR, still the place he used to work, but now he's doing this on a daily basis for Slate. Julia Postel, co-host of Literary Disco, is here. She's also director of writing at the Mark Twain House here in Hartford. When we come back, we're going to be talking about another podcast that we love called Song Exploder. We're going to be finding out some more of your favorites as well. And we're going to be talking about the business aspect of this. Does it really work? You know, tens of thousands of listeners versus hundreds of thousands of listeners. Can podcasting grow itself into something that maybe eventually takes down public radio? Gulp. You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we will revisit a program we did last year about suicide. The recent death of actor Robin Williams left many people shocked and restarted a national conversation about suicide, its warning signs, and ways to get help. We'll also hear a moving story about depression from author Andrew Solomon, who shared it with us at the Connecticut Forum earlier this year. I hope you can join us. Today in the program, we're talking with podcasters about podcasting. It's not new, but it's certainly something that's starting to, in many circles, overtake radio. If you look at the podcasting stats, the top podcasts, many of them are either hosted by people who are refugees from the traditional public radio system or squarely part of the NPR world. Will that be changing over the course of the next several years? We don't know. We'll hear from you next. Julia Pestel joins us. She's got a podcast called Literary Disco that she co-hosts. She's also director of writing at the Mark Twain House here in Hartford. Mike Pesca is host of the Slate daily podcast, The Gist. He also contributes reports and commentary to NPR. We listen regularly to Mike's podcast. Mike, one thing that's really different about this from traditional radio, you mentioned the All Things Considered story about the Eastern Warbler, right?
Yeah.
Maybe people will be enthralled by that and they'll write a little letter, or they'll be annoyed. They probably won't write a letter and say that's too many stories about Eastern Warblers. But at the end of the day, we have very different statistics. We pick things on radio and hope people like them, but we don't know minute by minute whether or not people dig them. However, in the world of podcasting, you get to see how many people download your episode day by day by day. Do the stats ever get, I don't know, overwhelming to look at?
No. They could be if you looked at it. Well, I would say that they have pretty accurate stats in the world of cable television news, and they sometimes pore over them, and we'll do story selection based on luck. It's whenever we go to a story on Congo, we lose 2/3 of our audience, so we'll never go to a story on Congo. But there's so much money sloshing around there, I guess that's why they're motivated to do so. Podcasting is a little bit in its nascent form. There is a way to make money on it. That's why I went to Slate full-time to do it, because it's possible as an advertising-supported medium. But you just have to appreciate all the information that's out there and then not get too consumed by it. Plus, maybe if it were the case that we saw huge fluctuations based on, you know, different editorial choices we made, it would be hard not to, you know, take that into account. But I think in general, people listen to your podcast and they don't select a specific story. They don't click around like they do with channels on cable news.
I just want to add
one thing. Yeah. I can't believe we haven't said yet. So I just go on to look at the stats because I want to feel good about myself, because I'm a nobody. And
that's not true.
But, you know, it makes me feel like, wow, I'm reaching all these people. And I've been recognized by my voice once or twice from the podcast or approached at book fairs. And the amazing thing about podcasts is that anyone can do them. And hopefully the quality of your podcast will rise it to the top, no matter who you are. Now, obviously, big outlets, you know, any Slate podcast is A, usually really good, and B, you know, has that automatic audience. But for things like Hardcore History, which is just some guy who loves history, or our podcast, you know, they're rising from often from just a completely average person, which is really, really great opportunity for a lot of people to get themselves out there.
But so then that really sets up the next piece of this, which is the business model for it. One business model is you, Julia. You know, you're just doing it with a couple friends. You're hoping that people like it. You're making sure that you get it out there as many ways as possible. But this isn't supported by some big organization that's put a lot of money into it. What's the game for you? How do you make sure that you can, you know, make enough money to keep going at this?
Well, we don't do it so often that it's our jobs. But I mean, I work in writing. I work at the Mark Twain House running our writing programs. One of them is one of our guys, Todd Goldberg, is an award-winning writer. And the third is Ryder Strong, who is an actor and director who a lot of people know. So we all do it enough that it satisfies our need to talk about books, but not so much that it becomes exhausting. So that's just how we do it. But we have looked into, you know, asking listeners for donations or putting Google ads on our site. But at this point, we're not spending so much time on it that it feels like anything other than a fun project that other people get to listen to if they feel like it.
So on the other side, Mike, you're part of one of these big Eastern, you know, podcast conglomerates, you know, like WNYC has a bunch of podcasts, including our friend Anna Sale, who does Death, Sex, and Money. We talked about Radiotopia, that's gathered together some of these great storytelling podcasts. Of course, Slate has its own suite of these things. Do you think that part of the business model for the podcast is maybe aligning yourself with one of these big organizations that knows how to get this out there just by sheer, you know, force of volume?
Well, I think the toughest thing about podcasts, it's very hard to point people to it if they would like it. So there are a few. I read on The Onion, they review a bunch of podcasts in their AV club, something called Podmass, and I'm not so into all the existing reviews. I kind of use it for two ways. One, there are a lot of those comedy podcasts like Comedy Bang Bang that are hit and miss. So their reviewer will give me an idea, this one's worth your time, this one's not. But in the beginning, they'll always say, hey, Outliers, here's a podcast that we've just heard about. And that's how I got into the Serial Killer podcast, which could be better. But so it does make sense. Just, you know, podcast is inventing itself and radio has this 100-year head start. And of course, there are consortiums and, you know, all the boring stuff about how to sell ads. But without that boring stuff about how to sell ads, a lot of these podcasts are going to go away. And with how to sell ads, other podcasts will thrive. So there's Earwolf, which is a bunch of comedy podcasts based mostly in LA. But since podcasts can be from anywhere, they are from anywhere. And some of the podcasts are aligning, given the networks. And this is just bubbling up. This is a new thing. And so they're aligning to do things like, you know, offer to advertisers a platform where you can reach more than just the 18,000 people or whatever who listen to the Flophouse. You could reach all 190,000 people listen to these five combined podcasts. And that's, I think that podcasts do a few things that radio don't or radio doesn't. And I think one of the things they do is they really hook and they really engage with the listeners. So we have all these stories where an advertiser will maybe give a code. So if you want to sign up for whatever service, you write the gist in the code, and people will call us and say, oh my God, I signed up, but I forgot to give your code. Like, they want to credit the podcast, and that just doesn't happen on the regular radio where anyone really cares to that extent.
We want to introduce another podcast producer, and the podcast is called Song Exploder. It's about how songs get made. Let's listen to a little clip here of rapper Open Mike Eagle talking about how he made his song Dark Comedy Morning Show. This is on Song Exploder.
For me to really, really get ready to write a song, it's like I have to let the beat get me pregnant almost. You know what I mean? Like I have to let the beat like live inside of me to the point where like I can recreate the beat in my head when I'm away from it over and over again. It's about like finding a frequency and answering whatever questions this beat is asking me. I can spend enough time with a beat in a few days to get that way, or in this case, I actually spent quite some time with it. Hanging out with it. It was a process. It was a little longer than it usually would take me, but I think that's more to do with just where I was in the album and trying to figure out a different way forward.
That's a bit from the podcast Song Exploder, which is produced by Hrishikesh Hirway, who joins us now on the phone. Hrishikesh, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So explain what Song Exploder does. What do you do with your podcast?
On my show, I take a song and get the stems, which means the individual layers that went into a recording. So just now, the clip that you were playing, that was just the guitar track from this beat on this Open Mike Eagle song. And I break it apart with the musician and talk to them about each piece individually. So these sort of discrete blocks of the song that normally you never get to hear. You only get to hear the finished product as a listener. So it's a chance to hear the song in a new way or learn about a song by hearing every little piece that went into it. And I interview them and then I remove myself from the interview and edit the episode together with the stems along with sort of little pieces of the interview. So it ends up being a pretty short thing, looking at four or five elements from each song.
What I love about it so much is I've always loved interviews with artists about process, but often those have to be intermingled with a lot of stuff about celebrity. Terry Gross is one who will talk with a writer about his writing process, but then has to talk about some controversy along the way because it is a broadcast show. You're able to nail into the process in a way that I think, as we talked about earlier, a lot of music nerds really like.
Yeah, I have found that I don't really like musician interviews. I don't like music documentaries. As a musician myself, I tend to find people talking about music, it can be really boring because I think that musicians, you know, it's not like a writer or a comedian where their job is to tell a story well or to entertain. Their job is to make music. So I try and keep the focus on just about the music and not delve into things that you normally hear in musician interviews, like biography and how did they get there? What are their, where did their name come from? What are their influences? The sort of questions that myself as a musician, I would get asked sometimes for press and kind of resent it.
So if people download your podcast, how often are you able to put these out?
I put up 2 a month.
And does that seem fairly doable, or is it a lot of work to get those 2 done with all the production you have to do?
It's a lot of work. It's manageable right now. Actually, you know, it takes me about 90 minutes to do an interview, and it takes me about 15 hours to edit an episode together afterwards. But the biggest part of it right now is just doing all the communication and booking guests. That's the most time-consuming. And I think the show's pretty new. As it goes on, I think that'll get easier.
The podcast is called Song Exploder. Hrishikesh Hirway is the producer. It's part of the Maximum Fun Podcast Network, along with other podcasts like The Memory Palace and Judge John Hodgman and NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it, and continued good luck.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, in just the last minute or so that we have with each of you, Julia Pestel, I'm going to give you a minute here to just pitch your podcast to people. A lot of people probably haven't heard it. Some have here. Make a pitch for our listeners to download your podcast. Go.
Sure. Okay. Well, I actually think that NPR listeners, perfect group to listen to Literary Disco, because what we do is we read widely and we try to vary our episodes between serious discussion while also having a sense of humor about ourselves and our books. So good places to start would be we have an episode on the Hardy Boys that's really funny, where we read aloud and enact some scenes, and then you can flip to really serious works of long nonfiction like 5 Days at Memorial, which is an awesome book by Sherry Fink that came out last year. But yeah, if you want to feel like you're in a room with people who like reading as much as you do and are very unapologetic about both reading and having opinions about books and have read a lot of the things that you've read and maybe more, you will like our podcast.
And the podcast is Literary Disco. The co-host is Julia Pestel. Thanks so much, Julia.
Oh, my pleasure. It's the best.
And you knew that this was going to happen, Mike. Now I've given you a minute to think about it. Make your pitch to my listeners for The Gist.
The Gist with Mike Pesca. Full disclosure, I am Mike Pesca, therefore it's one of my favorite podcasts. You get money-saving coupons, gifts for dads and grads, news you and your family can't live without, tip-offs to a rip-off, and the occasional Moldovan foreign policy analysis.
It's everything that you could need from a podcast. Mike, it's always very, very entertaining, and I always have it on when I'm trying to run in the afternoon. Mike Pesca, host of the Slate Daily Podcast, The Gist. Always good to talk to you. Thanks so much, Mike.
It also exfoliates.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives, who also edits Literary Disco together, we should say, and by Lydia Brown, who helps to edit together this program, including the one that you just heard today. The executive producer is Katie Talarski, who's been known to do a podcast or two herself. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.